This is Wyman and Bob
on Seattle Sports, powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
The NFL draft is right around the corner. Can't wait for that. Again, we'll be broadcasting wall-to-wall coverage of the draft from the opening round on, starting with me, you, Brock, Moyer, Bumpus. It's going to be a full house out there at the Virginia Mason Athletic Center, so definitely you don't want to miss that. But part of what we've talked about leading up to the draft is all of these mock drafts. Just love seeing everybody's perspective on that, and we get a guy who's done it himself, who's dug in deep on some of these mock drafts, and he's with us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. He is CBS Sports NFL Draft Analyst Josh Edwards is with us. Josh, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Yeah, you talked about those mock drafts. We've been doing one a week since September, so I think I've been through pretty much every scenario possible at this point.
Do you look at other mock drafts, whether it's from ESPN or NFL.com or any other source, and just sort of compare, like, wow, I had this guy going here, but they got him going here? Do you look at anybody else's opinions, or how do you handle all of the mock drafts that are out there, by which there are hundreds, it feels like?
Yeah, there certainly are. I would say there are certain teams that I look at. There's certain media analysts that I think they have a really good pulse on certain teams. So I may look at them in that regard, but typically I don't go out and look at a lot of mock drafts, just trying to keep my process as natural as possible. Yeah. I do look at prospect rankings and stuff like that other places just to make sure there's not any guys that I need to have graded before the actual draft occurs and stuff like that. But otherwise, just try to stay as close to my process as possible.
Well, and Josh, I just want everybody to appreciate the amount of work, because I've been doing just a little preview going into the draft here. We've got, I'll do three or four. But whenever I look at, a guy like, a pass rusher, whatever, I'm putting probably like 45 minutes into it to just look at one player. Like, how much time do you think you put in? I mean, this has got to be like you're working overtime doing this. That's a lot of information.
Yeah, there is a lot of information. Just from the film itself, I try to do a baseline of at least three games and ideally at least five games.
Wow.
For quarterbacks, it's essentially their entire season and, parts of the second season. In a lot of cases. And most of those tapes probably take 15 to 20 minutes apiece.
Yeah.
So you're talking about an hour for at least each prospect. And we try to get upwards of 400 throughout the process. So it's a lot of hours into it. But at the end of the day, I think it allows you to feel really confident about the opinions you do come to.
So as far as where you have guys going in your mock drafts, is – how much of that is just based on you're looking at team needs and here's a guy that fits their need, or is it based on contacts you have within organizations? Are you getting information that tells you, all right, they may be leaning toward a linebacker in this spot or an O-lineman or something like that?
It's a little bit of all that. You have better relationships with certain people within the league. Some you trust a little bit more than others because everybody has their own agenda this time of year. So even if you do hear stuff about certain teams, you try to do your own work just to kind of cross-reference it a little bit. A lot of it is looking at team needs. Some of it is knowing just where a team is currently in their roster construction process, because some of those teams are rebuilding. So you may not have to draft for need this year. Other teams are looking to compete for a Super Bowl, so you may be looking for that missing piece to that Super Bowl caliber roster. You look at the general manager's history. What have they done in the past? Where have they been previously? What have those teams like to do? Like the Jets, for example, Joe Douglas coming from Philadelphia. Philadelphia is one of those teams that overinvests in the offensive and the defensive lines. So on a yearly basis, if one of those two positions are available, I tend to give them a little bit more considerations with teams like the Jets that have some of those Philadelphia ties, and of course the Eagles as well, because they always tend to draft offensive or defensive linemen. So you take a lot of things into consideration and just try to arrive at a point that makes the most sense.
Well, and Josh, from your standpoint, what have you noticed about the Seahawks and, excuse me, and John Schneider? And, you know, we think that it's purely best player, but sometimes, you know, you have need kind of creep in there. But what do you think has been the characteristic of John Schneider?
Yeah, I think they are a team that tries to stick to best player available. A lot of times it ends up being on the defensive side of the ball. Even last year with Devin Witherspoon, I think, you know, might have been a little bit of a surprise for where they took him, given the return of Tariq Woolen. It's a team that is not afraid to think outside of the box and make a pick that is, you know, not widely accepted by the draft media. There was a period where those first-round picks were not hitting, and, you know, there was a little bit of skepticism about their process. And in the past couple of years, they've knocked it out of the park. I mean, 2 years ago was – I said – at the end of the draft, I said, I don't think they have any questionable picks from this draft. That was the Tariq Woolen draft where they took Charles Cross, they took Abe Lucas. I thought they hit it out of the park, and as we've now seen, they truly did. So just looking through their process, they're not somebody that is going to stick to the conventional rankings. They've got their own convictions, and at the end of the day, they're going to stick to their board and take the best player that they feel is available.
So looking at the picks you had for the Seahawks here, and you went through and did their, you know, they've got seven picks as we sit right now. We'll see what kind of moves they make, if any. But you've got them going with Troy Faltanu out of Washington as their first pick. And then a lot of mock drafts have that. Is that, again, based on what you see as a need, which it certainly is a need for the team, but the idea that he would be the best player available as well at that time? Or was it more about, well, they've got some holes on that O-line that need to be addressed?
I think it's a perfect marriage of need and value at that point, because I do think that Troy Faltanu is a really sensational talent. I think he, you know, moves really well for being an offensive lineman. He played left tackle for Washington. Of course, that Husky staff, specifically on offense, is now with the Seahawks. So there's some familiarity there. They need offensive guard help because Damian Lewis is gone, and they probably needed guard help even before he was gone. So I think it makes a lot of sense based on their needs. And I think he's probably going to be one of the best players available when we reach that stage of the first round. Plus the familiarity that he has with the coaching staff. It just makes a lot of sense, especially coming off a season where they had injuries to the offensive tackles. So to have a guard now that has that positional flexibility to play on the edge if you were to succumb to injuries again, I think has to be incredibly appealing. So it is a combination of need and value in that pick, but it's one that I personally love as much as any other in this draft. I think it makes a ton of sense on a lot of levels.
Hey, tell us, Josh, one of the more, I don't know if it's controversial or maybe just a surprise, that J.J. McCarthy has moved up, and I think you have him at number four going to Minnesota. But what do you see from him? What is it about him that, because if you look at his numbers, obviously not great, but they had a great running game. What is it about him that NFL teams love?
I think it's his toughness, the way that he approaches the game. He's an incredibly accurate passer. He throws with rhythm. He's capable of making all throws to the field. We just haven't necessarily seen it as consistently as we have some of these other top quarterback prospects. It's easy to fall in love with the impromptu playmaking skill set of a Caleb Williams. It's easy to fall in love with the size, the arm strength of Drake May. And I think with McCarthy, it's just the fact that he's won at every single level of football that he has played. And it sounds a little bit tacky, you know, that would be such a heavy part of the process. But every team that he has sat down with throughout the course of the pre-draft process has just fallen in love with the way that he approaches the game, the way that his teammates speak about him, the way that his coaches speak about him. He's just a player that has found a way to win at every single level. So he's got all the intangibles that you look for in a leader at the quarterback position. And I think he's got more than enough skill set as a quarterback to make that happen. I think he's incredibly, incredibly gifted as a passer within the pockets. That's something that I look for first and foremost, because you have to be able to operate within the pocket before you worry about all of the extracurricular stuff about being able to make plays in space. And I think he does that as well as anybody in this draft class.
Where did you have, in your latest mock, where did you have Michael Penix going? He's fascinating. Obviously, out here, we're very familiar with him. He was a stud with the Huskies, led the nation in passing. By all accounts, he absolutely stole the show amongst the quarterbacks at the Combine, repeated that at his pro day, yet there still seems to be this doubt about him. I don't know if it's physically or what the feeling is about him, but he doesn't seem to, despite those performances and what the numbers he put up, a lot of mocks have him second, some third round. What is it that's holding him back? Is it strictly the previous injuries?
It is his injury past. It's a little bit scary, but I have not heard from any teams that the medicals were a big concern. So it sounds like he has checked that. But I do think in the back of their mind, there are some teams that are a little bit leery of his past. I think more so the issue for me is just that he's not that creative passer outside of the pocket. He is predominantly a pocket passer, and he hasn't quite shown what you would hope in terms of secondary movements. So I think that's where it's limiting. And I think he has the capability to do that. I think it's his preference to operate in the pocket, and maybe there's some hesitancy because of the injuries in his past. But when you look at the guys that are often mentioned alongside of him, the Drake Mays of the world, the Caleb Williams, they've shown a little bit more creativity outside of the pocket. So I think for me, that's where I tend to favor him a little bit more as a possible day two pick instead of first half of the first round, which some people are discussing. But at the end of the day, I think it all depends what happens with those first three quarterbacks. If they are taken 1, 2, 3, then suddenly there's a little bit of urgency. There's a little bit of desperation. And that's going to affect how others attack the position, because suddenly the supply is being limited, and there's no less of a demand. So once your supply is low and the demand is equal, there's going to be this point in the middle where teams are going to be desperate and overdraft that position. So if J.J. McCarthy were to come off the board in the top five, which a lot of people suspect that he will, I think it becomes very interesting there with where that next quarterback run begins, because I think the team like the Raiders could be interested there in the top half of the first round.
Hey, Josh, I just kind of raved last year about Bijan Robinson because, you know, he knew he was going to be a top pick and he did everything. You know, he did the combine, he did the pro day, which was like less than a week after the combine. And I've always, you know, said that's a bonus because to me, it shows that you love football. You love every part of it. You want to compete. And Marvin Harrison Jr., you know, is one of those guys. And I know that there are a few others that don't, you know, participate in the pro day or the combine. I think it's a huge deal. What do you think? Am I discounting him a little bit too much?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think there are some valid concerns, but at the end of the day, I think that he has shown enough throughout the course of his career to be discussed in the range that he's being discussed. But it's going to be interesting because that is a position that's getting a lot of attention right now.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, Dave and I were talking about it, and for some reason it bothers me that he's not doing anything, like even in his pro. The combine, I think we've become used to the top-tier players not participating in the drills and whatnot, but usually they work out at their pro day. But there's something about somebody who just says, no, I'm not going to do any of it. Look at my tape. I don't know. I'm sure he's getting the advice from his handlers and his agents and things like that. But it just, if I'm a GM, there's something about that that sits wrong with me. And maybe that's just an old fashioned way of looking at it.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting because I was there for CJ Stroud's pro day last year. And he was out there running routes and stuff for that. So it's kind of ironic and funny that he was partaking in CJ Stroud's pro day. And then a year later, he was kind of sitting it out himself. But I think he has shown enough throughout the course of this process that he has warranted that top consideration, that he feels he doesn't have to go out there and prove himself anymore. I have him as my top rated wide receiver, but a lot of people think Malik Nabers could be there. And I think it's going to be a team by team basis because some teams may look for a more twitchy wide receiver that can make plays post catch. Whereas I think Marvin Harrison Jr. just gives you a higher floor, and he gives you a little bit more ball-winning ability downfield. So it's all about what you're looking for in that position. For a team like the Chargers, you took a big-bodied wide receiver last year with Quentin Johnston. Do you want to go down that path again so early, even though Johnston really hasn't worked out? With the Giants, I think Malik Nabers is a really good complement to what they already have on the roster. And then Arizona, looking at their past, you had Larry Fitzgerald, you had A.J. Green. So do you favor size at that position? I think it really depends who is going to take that first wide receiver off the board and who is ultimately going to be that first wide receiver taken, because I think that matters.
So how big of a gap do you feel there is, if any substantial gap, between Harrison Jr., Nabers, and Roma Dunze?
It's a very slim margin. I've got Harrison as my number one overall prospect. I've got Nabers as my number three overall, and Adunze, I believe, is number four overall. So in any given year, these guys would be the top wide receiver in this draft class. It just all happened where they came together in such a tremendous year for the position. A lot of teams are throwing the ball a lot more than they used to. So you're seeing wide receivers get a lot more reps than they used to previously. So they're coming out a lot more polished. They're being more well-trained in route running. They're getting the specialized training after the season. So these players are coming out ready to compete in the NFL. So at the end of the day, I don't think it matters so much where each person has these players stacked up, because at the end of the day, I think when we look back on this draft class, it's very possible we're talking about the top three of the top 10 wide receivers in the entire NFL.
Hey, Josh, I was looking at your mock draft. You have Dallas Turner, it looks like, being the best pass rusher. I looked at, and I think it's Jeff Kerr that has the Seahawks getting Leiatu Latu. I just fell in love with that guy, with Latu. I felt like he was the most talented pass rusher. I mean, most finished. He's got, you know, he's got everything that you need. He's hard to block. I think you have him going to the Rams, but you think Dallas Turner is probably the best pass rusher in this league, and how much of a gap between him and Latu?
Again, I think it's a conversation of need versus talent ceiling. I think Dallas Turner has a higher ceiling at the position because he's still relatively young. He's developing at the position. Doesn't quite have the strength that Leiatu Latu has. Latu is probably the most polished pass rusher in this draft class. And to me, I wouldn't be surprised if we were looking back in 5 years saying that he was the best pass rusher to come out of this class, because he's already the most prepared to make that transition to the next level. But from what I know about NFL teams, they tend to fall in love with the athletic traits and those qualities, and they take those players higher. I mean, that's why we saw Trevon Walker taken number one overall. He hadn't exactly shown a lot throughout his collegiate career, but he tested off the charts in Indianapolis, so now he's got to be the number one overall pick. So that's what it boils down to for me. I think Turner has a higher ceiling, but if I were to put money down today on a player that I think is going to have the most early success in the NFL, it would be Latu, because I think he's better positioned to make that transition.
Do you see any chance that the top three aren't quarterbacks, whether it's the order that everybody has picked? You know, everybody's got Caleb Williams first, then I've seen May second for the most part, and followed by Daniels, but I've seen some Daniels second, May third. Do you think those three represent the top three almost certainly?
Yeah, I do. So who was it? Sorry, can you say the three again that you mentioned?
Caleb Williams, Drake May, and Jaden Daniels?
Yeah.
In some order?
Yeah, so I actually have J.J. McCarthy. That's why I had you clarify that. I actually have J.J. McCarthy rated a little bit higher than I do Jaden Daniels because of his ability to operate within the pocket. I feel a little bit more comfortable with his ability to transition to the next level. Jaden Daniels obviously offers the dual threat skill set where he can make plays when the play breaks down. But McCarthy has a higher floor to me as a passer, and I think you have to start there before you start considering all of the other stuff. So So I have Caleb Williams as my top-rated quarterback, followed by Drake May, and then J.J. McCarthy and Jaden Daniels. But I'm not going to sit here and say that I know better than anybody else, because even the people that are best at picking players in the NFL miss on that position. It is the most difficult position to figure out in sports. We have a hit rate of about 50% in the first round. So you're talking about half the quarterbacks even picked in the first round being failures. So as much as anybody wants to say this player is going to be successful, this player is going to be a bust in the NFL, I think a lot of it has to do with the supporting cast. What you're walking into with the offensive scheme, the coaching staff, and the other skill talents around you, what kind of an offensive line is going to be protecting them? I think a lot of times the early success that a rookie quarterback is able to have, building that confidence is just so important throughout the rest of their career, and not all teams are equipped to provide that.
Josh Edwards, CBS Sports NFL draft analyst, has been our guest here with Wyman and Bob. Josh, great stuff, man. We really appreciate you taking the time, and can't wait to see how this will all turn out on draft night. So thanks so much for the time.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Josh.
Josh Edwards.
Puts a lot of work in, man.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to ask. Should ask him. So are you going to go back and look at your final mock and just see, grade yourself? How'd I do?
Yeah.
Was I 60%? Was I 70?
You know what I like to ask them is, hey, when are you starting next year's mock draft?
Yeah, that's a lot of them.
They want to shoot you.
They're like the next day. Yeah. Start breaking down that class. All right. Our thanks to Josh for joining us. Coming up, will Jonathan Clase be the spark the Mariners offense needs? We're going to get into that next with Wyman and Bob. This is Seattle Sports on 710.
Wyman and Bob.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
Mariners taking on the Reds tonight, game one of their three-game series. George Kirby will be on the hill for the Mariners. Hopefully he gets back to being George Kirby. They could use that. Take some pressure off an offense that already seems to be putting enough pressure on themselves.
He was, you know what, that was one of the more surprising things. That outing he had against Cleveland.
His last two.
Was really bad. I thought that one was particularly bad. He looked out of control. And then.
Still hasn't walked anybody in those two starts, though.
No.
As dreadful as they were, and they were dreadful. It's kind of funny that, I guess it's not funny because he was getting his tail kicked, but he just doesn't walk anybody.
It's funny, weird, not funny, ha-ha.
Exactly right.
It just shows his dedication to, he's not going to walk anyone. I feel like he's more competitive about that than
he's giving up hits as opposed to walks.
Yeah.
Which is
surprising.
So hopefully he resembles the Kirby we all know and love. And hopefully the defense is able to back him up, make it so he doesn't have to be perfect. If he gives up two runs, you don't feel like it's insurmountable that, game's over. Because they scored a total of three runs combined in the last two games. They are 1-for-15 with runners in scoring position in the last two games. They've left 14 on base in those two games, and they've struck out 18 times combined in the last two games. 10 last night, 8 the game before. Offense is not good right now, to say the very least.
Well, I was just scouring the bottom of the rankings and finding lots of categories that the Mariners are not good at, which is average,
all of them.
On-base percentage, OPS.
Look at runs, hits, look at it all, Dave.
And I'm looking I'm looking at the Reds, and I mean, they're kind of middle of the pack. You know, they're anywhere from 11 to 15, whether you're talking about slugging, OPS, average. But Mariners, 26 to 30. I know that we've beaten that to death, but it's just what's going on right now, and whatever the solution is, I don't think that there's any one thing, like a magic bullet. I don't think if you went and changed the order around that it's magically going to just all of a sudden help. But, you posed a question last night about, like, at what point do you get to where, like, maybe coaches or, I'm not talking about service, obviously, but, we haven't gotten the much of an effect of the Brant Brown hiring, and
you say you've got no effect. I mean, This is dreadful what we're watching. And I'm not saying it's his fault. They just, it's, I don't know what's not clicking with the lineup. I don't know. It's a collective. We always hear the old adage, you know, hitting is contagious. Well, is not hitting contagious as well? Does everybody get tight? You know, everybody's struggling. You got so many guys in your lineup that are hitting under 200. I mean, they're just, you know, some bad luck. We've talked about, you know, Rayleigh hit the ball, squared it up, hit it right at a guy. Third baseman in the game before last made a couple of big plays at third base where the ball was hit hard. You're going to have those moments, but there are other moments where you're just not capitalizing. As we talked about, 1-for-15 with runners in scoring position. Not all 15 of those plate appearances were, you know, hey, bad luck. They all scalded the ball. They just hit it right at. So that's not how that's been. We've had, you know, Ty France hitting into double plays and just guys just not coming through. And it's incumbent upon them. Some of these guys, Ty France isn't a young guy. You know, Julio, this is his third year in the league. JP's not the young guy. You give somebody like Canzone, who has yet to play a full major league season, I cut him a little bit of a break. He's a young guy who's still figuring out the big leagues. But, you know, everybody else, you don't really have that excuse. And now they're going to call up another young guy who maybe he will, Class A, maybe he'll be a spark because Canzone, in case you missed it, he's on the 10-day IL with that shoulder injury running into the wall yesterday. And Class A has been called up, and he was raking in AAA, and we saw him in spring training. He looked good. Again, take those numbers for what they are. We'll see what happens up here. He's another guy. He's a little dude. Him, Samad Taylor, Ryan Bliss, all really small guys. I think he's listed. I think Class A is listed at like 5'9".
Urias is not the biggest dude.
No, he seems a little more stockier than these guys. Because I think Class A, we were looking at it today. I think he's listed like 5'9", 165 or something like that, which means he's probably 5'8", 150. You know, I mean, they're just little dudes. But hey, I don't care. They can all be Altuve for I care. Just go out there and make something happen. Just, you know, maybe it helps that he's not coming with the burden of, man, I've been struggling for weeks now, and all the fans are mad, and everybody's uptight. He doesn't have that baggage coming up.
Yeah. Marshall in Leavenworth says, come on, guys, it's ball bearings. We all know that. That's a line from Fletch. He says, it's pitch recognition, guys. Come on. It's all done with ball bearings.
What was that character's name? Was it G. Liddy?
G. Gordon Liddy?
Was that what it was?
I believe so.
Yeah, looks like the Fetzer valve.
Don't tell me my business, boy.
Yeah, it's kind of these windows with all this dirt and muck on there.
Yeah, how about this? 425 says, is Garver more valuable right now than Colton Wong last year?
Oh, yeah.
Is Luke Rayleigh right now better than A.J. Pollock last year?
No, I was actually looking at Rayleigh to see if he had options left because I was like, maybe they could option him down to AAA, and then once the 10 days are up for Taylor, they could call Taylor back up.
Yeah.
Samad Taylor. I would just love to see him. He may come up here and do nothing, but I just like he brings an element that doesn't currently exist on the team as quick as he is. He looked great in spring as well.
A lot of energy from that guy.
Yeah. Another little dude who could be a spark plug. If you wanted to give JP a break and bump him down in the lineup, then maybe Taylor's a guy you could insert there. So once his, you know, you got 10 days from when he was sent down to call him back up. So once that's up, I don't know. We found out Rayleigh doesn't have any options. So that's not a go. But he plays outfield. Rayleigh's an outfield guy. He could occupy that spot and logically, I think, could produce a lot more. Because Rayleigh's struggled. He hasn't gotten a lot of opportunity. But yeah, Garver, I mean, these guys just haven't done it the way you'd hope. Polanco, hopefully that's the beginning. He did hit the two-run home run. They lost, but maybe that'll be something that gets him going, takes some of the pressure off of him, and he starts becoming the producer everybody hoped he would be when they brought him over.
Yeah. By the way, you said spark plug. Remember something about Mary? No, I said.
Yes, I do. You can't say that.
We won't say that. Not spark plug, but another kind of plug.
Who are you talking about, roller pig? Let's just do movie lines. Let's not talk about the marriage.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to work around it. What's the answer? I mean, somebody was asking me on the text. I'll have to find it who it was. But we're saying, you know, what about, and I was talking to Bump and Stacy about this, like, at what point do you know that everything is pretty much like the ship is sinking, you know? So yeah. I was telling a story about how last year, in 1992, when we were 2-14, I thought we were going to the Super Bowl. I thought we were going to the playoffs for sure that year. And then, you know, and then I think Stacy asked, well, at what point did you know that, okay, you're pretty bad? Because I was talking about the fifth worst offense in NFL history. And I said, you know, it was during the season. It was about week five or six. And I was playing scout team linebacker just to help out. And they ran a running play. And I was unblocked in the hole and could have just crushed the running back. And I was like, coach, I raised my hand. I'm like, who's blocking me? And he goes, we'll run right through you. And I'm like, okay. Sure enough, I saw that play in the game. Linebacker comes up and just gives the running back a headache. I'm like, oh, God, here we go. We're not good.
I'm surprised it took 5 weeks for you to figure out that offense was not going to be very good.
Well, maybe it was sooner. Yeah, it was. But, yeah, I mean, as far as that goes, what's the one little thing that you put in there that, you know, maybe it's Class A? Well, I hope so. But if that's the case, I'm like, well, why did that have to happen? Why can't our players just be good? Why can't they be what we thought they were going to be in spring and coming into this season? So, but, you know, look, that happens every year. Like I said, the comparison to Wong and, you know, whether it was Winker or any of those
Pollock
guys
Stella
that they brought in. Yeah, it just, I mean, maybe it's just not going to work out. I just remember Jerry saying, I go, look, we thought those guys were good. We brought them in. They just didn't, it didn't work out. I'm like, yeah, it didn't. I mean, sometimes, because if you look at the year that they had before, especially with Winker and Frazier, I'm like, you look at I think they were both hitting 300. And I'm like, well, what happened? What the hell happened?
Winker and Teoscar were the ones. Winker was an epic failure. Teoscar was just okay last year. He gave you some production. He struck out a whole bunch. He was dreadful in the outfield.
Yeah, well, that's good news. He had the same strikeout numbers.
Yeah, yeah. So he was, I loved the Teoscar pickup when that happened. I loved it. And he just didn't pan out the way they had hoped that we had all hoped. But the other guys, we talked about it a million times when they went with Pollock and Stella and Wong and Hummel. I was like, what are we doing? What is that about? That's about saving money is what that was. So, and you got what you paid for. All right, coming up, one NBA player gave away free food in the middle of his game yesterday. We're going to hear about that when we sweep the dial. Coming up with Wyman and Bob, this is Seattle Sports on 710.
Scanning the airwaves for the most interesting and entertaining stories of the day. Sweeping the dial. Every afternoon at 4:45 with Wyman and Bob.
Now, I'm not sure what really was the big grievance when they were here, but the Red Sox were in Seattle to start the season. And yesterday, their TV broadcasters were talking about a home run celebration and managed to bring up the fact that they're not fans of the Mariners' Trident celebration.
And I think you're absolutely right on these home run celebrations. Come up with it sort of on the fly, as opposed to what some teams are doing, like, hey, hand the guy a trident that we had an engineer, you know, 3,000 miles away, create in a lab somewhere, mail to you.
Yeah, and there's the medal. It's going to go around a little bit, but, you know. But I actually think when the year's up, you come up with something new. You don't need the laundry cart 2-3 years in a row. I mean, that was a couple years ago. Find something new.
Half the fun is something new.
Your Coors Medal.
Yeah, they created that trident in a lab. They got a group of scientists together. Shut up, Dave O'Brien. What are you whining about? What do you care?
Let
these teams have fun. Everybody talks about how stodgy and old baseball is, and you know, we embrace the celebrations. Embrace the whether it's the home run celebration around the bases, you know, the Tatis sort of dance move almost he does around third, whatever.
Well, is that customary to change it each year? That's what they were kind of complaining about. Come up with something new.
Well, they're complaining about it in general and then saying, well, at least change it. I mean, let each team do whatever the hell they want. Who cares?
Well, Toronto has
The jacket
with
all
the patches
on it. Yeah.
And then you've got somebody who does a wagon ride or something.
They were talking about the laundry cart.
Is that Cleveland?
I don't know who does
the,
that.
The Orioles have one that they've repeated, which I guess is
the
blasphemy.
Water one where
they have a device used to drink quickly, and they put water in it.
You're talking about a beer bong?
No, it's a water bong, Dave.
Okay.
That was my point of not saying it.
It's a beer bong. Yeah. Hit it again!
They sound like...
It tastes so good when it hits your lips.
They sound like grumpy old men. They just sounded like, you know.
A lot of people think that about us.
Well, I don't have any problems with these celebrations.
Yeah, really, I don't either. I think the Trident is badass. You know what?
I'm just glad the scientists got in the lab and created such a unique, advanced...
That was strange.
But item like that.
I'll tell you what, though. Here's what makes it great, that there's danger involved, because... Divish told me that thing is like as heavy as a digging bar.
Yeah, didn't you hold it?
They
brought it out when we were there. Was it when Felix came out? I think. Yeah. I have a picture of me holding it. They brought it out. It's got weight.
Sharp.
To it,
right? They know Dave's history.
Yeah,
he's not allowed to hold it.
No, it would be when it was in somebody else's hand. Somehow I would.
He'd swing his arms talking, and he'd cut his arm on it.
Bob threw a trident. I think you might be wanted for murder.
Sweeping the dial.
Okay, I think you guys will like this one then. These two broadcasters, the exact opposite tone. So final game of the NBA season, the Rockets TV broadcasters realize, and this is the end of the game in the fourth quarter, they realize that Boban Marjanovic is about to miss his second free throw on purpose in order to give Clippers fans free Chick-fil-A.
Fans are getting excited here. There might potentially be some free chicken on the board if he misses the second free throw.
Oh man, free chicken on the board.
Yeah, so that's why the fans are getting a little frothy.
Oh, they're pointing to him. Boban's playing with the crowd. Say, you want chicken?
Here's your job.
Oh, he gave him chicken. He's a man of the people. He's a man of the people.
Did he get that on purpose?
He did. He gave out free chicken.
Boy, being that excited about what do you get, a free sandwich or something?
Just literally a free Chick-fil-A sandwich.
He's a man of the people. That's awesome. So what, you have to, I assume,
the promotion. So this was the road team too. So they were in LA. It's a Clippers promotion that if the visiting team misses two free throws at any point in the fourth quarter, two free throws in a row, all the fans in attendance get free chicken. You know, they want the crowd to get into it, to have a home court advantage. So the Rockets is the road team. You know, Boban, I guess, missed the first, saw maybe a sign for the promotion, and then got the fans hyped up and missed the second.
Wow. That's funny. That's the excitement of that call. He's a man of the people.
All over a chicken sandwich.
Yeah.
Boy.
Sweeping the dial.
Hey, final day of the NBA season. Had to get excited about something. Yeah. The Rockets season was over after that, so pretty harmless, pretty fun there. But back to a thing we talked about on Friday that I know that you and Paul Moyer feel strongly about, Dave. Scottie Scheffler, his wife, was going to potentially go into labor. That was the big story. So she didn't go into labor. All was good. He won the Masters. Then he was asked about that, if at any point during that final round, he thought what would happen if his wife did decide to go into labor.
You know, I guess that's a testament to how good of a headspace I was in. I wasn't thinking about that much. I was doing my best to stay in the moment, stay calm, execute shots. I was very focused out there today. I felt like I did a really good job. You know, Teddy did a great job of making sure that we kept the golf course in front of us. You know, I didn't get off to the best start, but had some key up and downs. And you know, Teddy once again did a great job of keeping me in it. And we had a great week.
Yes, but would you have left had she gone into labor in the middle of your round?
But it's a $3.6 million question, Bob. And, you know, you could give that kid a hell of an education with $3.6 million.
I think you're tipping your hand as to which way you would have gone. But
well, I told Shannon that you totally jammed me up at the ballpark. Yeah, because you said, what if Shannon came to you and said, you have to be there? I was like, I would be there. Maybe that's why I had the standoff at Home Depot.
because you felt like you gave in on the childbirth thing?
Yeah.
The hypothetical childbirth thing. I gave in on that. I'm not giving in on this.
Yeah. We're not having babies, that's for sure. But yeah, $3.6 million. So, I mean, honestly, it's a financial deal there. Again, all bets are off if there's complications and things like that. So, you know, I understand that part. But I mean, seriously,
your run-of-the-mill childbirth.
I think a lot of women can, you know, including my wife, a lot of women would say, go make us money, right? Not to be money grubbing, but that's what you do. And this is an opportunity. And the thing is, you know, with golf, you only hurt yourself. But if you're the starting pitcher and it's game seven and you're the ace, there's lots of guys relying on you.
Yeah.
So I mean, at least this one's clean. You only hurt yourself. So I don't. I mean,
you're still struggling with this one.
I seriously doubt, though. I seriously doubt that he would have walked away.
You think he would have said, "Well, I hope everything goes well. I got 9 holes left," yeah, or whatever.
I just remember on the day of both of my child's births, I was very useless. There wasn't much for me. I was just trying to get out of the way.
And they were both off season.
Yeah.
So you were never faced with that dilemma.
Never faced with that dilemma.
That's a good thing.
I'm fascinated by it, though.
It is a very polarizing topic, Dave, yeah, as we've come to learn. All right. Coming up, the Mariners and the Reds have been closely connected over the last few seasons, and we'll learn more about this matchup from Reds TV broadcaster John Sadick. He will join us next year with Wyman and Bob. This is Seattle Sports on 710.